Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
dearest Mother,
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Reading from the vision from Papa Answers. This is December of this year's edition. Devotee, have the clothes we wear any influence on the spiritual life?
Papa,
no, unless it be for one who has renounced all desires for the world or attachment for the world, and lives a life completely cut off from the world. For him it is important. For a seeker of truth, not engaged in any other activities, the peculiar dress he puts on helps him to remember that his life is dedicated to God. When his dedication has become complete and realization of God is achieved, it is immaterial what dress he puts on. Ramdas tells this from his own experience. He was wearing ochre-colored clothes during his early years of spiritual sadhana, or God-seeking. He continued dressing that way for about 3 or 4 years, after which he gave them up and started wearing white clothes commonly used by all. When he had the colored clothes on, he was feeling that his life was a dedicated one. The ochre color signifies renunciation. So whenever he looked at the cloth, he felt this life was God's, and not to be used for anything except for the realization and the service of God. Thus, it was helpful, though it is not always essential. Devotee, most teachers say that we should remain in the world and strive for God realization, but in almost all cases, the teachers themselves withdrew from the world for realization. Papa, for some, it is necessary that they should retire from the world for a long period and live in solitude for realizing God. For some others, a short period of seclusion now and again is of great help. They do not feel the need for cutting themselves away from the world for a long time. The object of retiring from the world is to uproot from the mind hate, wrath, and all the desires. Those who do so feel they are not able to remove these, remaining active in the world, where they would come in daily contact with persons whose life not such as to encourage them on the spiritual path. It is necessary to avoid such worldly surroundings, go into solitude, and get established in divine consciousness. Then one may return to the world, love those whom one was hating, move on friendly terms with those who were once disliked, and maintain peace and joy in all activities. It is not absolutely necessary that one should go away entirely from the world. There were saints who lived a family life and who still were able to be detached from the world and remember God constantly. Ram Dass remembers a beautiful line of Emerson. The great man is he who enjoys the sweetness of solitude in the midst of the crowd. You must be in the crowd and still feel all alone. From our wonderful translation of the Gita that I found just recently,
by Stephen Mitchell. It came out just this year, I believe. Copyright year 2000. And it's in honor of Sri Ramana Maharshi. What it lacks in some of the details, it makes up for in poetic imagery and flow of ideas. This is chapter 9, The Secret of Life. The Blessed Lord said, "Because you trust me, Arjuna, I will tell you what wisdom is, the secret of life. Know it and be free of suffering forever. This is the supreme wisdom, the knowing beyond all knowing, experienced directly in a flash, eternal, and a joy to practice. Those who are without faith in my teaching cannot attain me. They endlessly return to this world, shuttling between death to death. I permeate all the universe in my unmanifest form. All beings exist within me. Yet I am so inconceivably vast, so beyond existence, that though they are brought forth and sustained by my limitless power, I am not confined within them. Just as the all-moving wind, wherever it goes, always remains in the vastness of space, all beings remain within me. They are gathered back into my womb at the end of the cosmic cycle, 150,000 billion of your earthly years. And as a new cycle begins, I send them forth once again, pouring from my abundance the myriad forms of life. These actions do not bind me, Arjuna. I stand apart from them all, indifferent to their outcome, unattached, serene. Under my guidance, nature brings forth all beings, all things, animate or inanimate, and sets the whole universe in motion. Foolish people despise me in the human form that I take, blind to my true nature as the Lord of all life and death. Their hopes and actions are vain. Their knowledge is sheer delusion. Turning from the light, they fall into cruelty, selfishness, greed. But the truly wise, Arjuna, who dive deep into themselves, fearless, one-pointed, know me as the inexhaustible source. Always chanting my praise, steadfast in their devotion, they make their lives an unending hymn to my endless love. Others on the path of knowledge know me as the many, the one. Behind the faces of a million gods, they can see my face. I am the ritual and the worship, the medicine and the mantra, the butter burnt in the fire, flames that consume it. I am the father of the universe and its mother, essence and goal of all knowledge, the refiner, the sacred Om, and the threefold Vedas. I am the beginning and the end, origin and dissolution, refuge, home, true lover, womb and imperishable seed. I am the heat of the sun. I hold back the rain and release it. I am death and the deathless, and all that is or is not. The righteous who follow the scriptures strictly, who drink the soma and are purified of their sins, who pray to be taken to heaven, they reach the world of the gods and enjoy an indescribable bliss, although after eons of those vast and glorious pleasures, when their merit is spent, they fall back into the mortal world. Impelled by desire, they achieve only what will pass away. But those who meditate on me, undistracted, and worship me everywhere, always will I bring a reward that can never be lost. Arjuna, all those who worship me, all those who worship other gods with deep faith are really worshiping me, even if they don't know it. For I am the only object and the only enjoyer of worship, and they fall back because they cannot know me as I truly am. Worshipping the gods, men go to the gods. Worshipping spirits,
to the spirits. Worshipping me, they come to me in the end. Any offering, a leaf, a flower, or fruit, a cup of water, I will accept it if given with a loving heart. Whatever you do, Arjuna, do it as an offering to me. Whatever you say or eat or pray or enjoy or suffer, and in this way you will be freed from all the results of your actions. Good or harmful, unfettered, untroubled, you will come to me. I am the same to all beings. I favor none and reject none. But those who worship me live within me, and I live in them. Even the heartless criminal, if he loves me with all his heart, will certainly grow into sainthood as he moves towards me on this path. Quickly, that man becomes pure. His heart finds eternal peace. Arjuna, no one who truly loves me will ever be lost. All those who love and trust me, even the lowest of the low, prostitutes, beggars, slaves, will attain the ultimate goal. How much easier then for ordinary people, for those with pure hearts in this sad, vanishing world, turn to me and find freedom. Concentrate your mind on me. Fill your heart with my presence. Love me, serve me, worship me, and you will attain me at last. Thrilling words and a thrilling promise. There's the story of Sage Valmiki, who wrote the glorious Ramayana. Valmiki turned in the beginning of his life, into a robber and a brigand. He justified this because he had a wife and family that he needed to feed. But as he grew to be a terror of the highways, everyone was afraid of him. He would pounce on people, he would kill them, he would take their money, and he would walk away, seemingly heartless, without any thought of what he was doing. One day, he came upon a being walking along the road. Now, this being was an unusual man. He was a great devotee of gods. His name was Narayana. And as he is about to pounce on him and stab him and take his life from him for whatever he might have done, he looked into Sage Narayana's head. And there he found that there was a look that he had never seen before. It was beautiful, unafraid of him. Now, in all of his life, he had never seen such a look. Everyone that he had met was either afraid of him or would instantly become enraged and fight against him. But here he saw within those eyes an unfathomable look, a look as if looking upon the deepest of oceans, unmoved by his own pouncing upon him. And so he asked the man, he says, "Why is it that you look at me like that? How is it that you're able to look at me? No man has been able to face me without terror or rage in his heart." And so Narayana told him that he was indeed unafraid of him. Valmiki asked why. He said it was because that he knew God alone, and he saw only God in Valmiki. Now, if you put yourself in Narayana's shoes and think of yourself walking down a path and suddenly seeing somebody pouncing upon you, you can see what a great and difficult task that is, to be able to stay calm, cool under the circumstances, see that individual as God, and to be completely unafraid. Well, Valmiki continued to question the sage as to how it was that he is able to stay so calm. And then Valmiki says, "I will answer you, but you answer me a question first." He says, "How is it that you rob and kill people without any thought for what you're doing or your victims, or even for yourself, in the sense that
there's karma. For every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. Don't you realize that? Well, Valmiki kind of said in a bland kind of way, yes, I suppose I know that there's consequences for what I do. But I do it for my family. Because they need to eat, I sustain them in this way. Narayana asked him, would his family be willing to share in the karmic hell that he would certainly have to endure for his actions? Valmiki says, I'm quite sure that they would. So he said, well, why don't you go and ask them? And I will wait. So Valmiki went off and he asked his family, first his wife and then his children, would they share in the karmic hell that was surely to come to him for his actions? Each one of them said no. The wife said no. It's up to the husband to provide for the wife, that she wouldn't take any share of it whatsoever. Well, he was very disappointed in this. He went through all of his children, and not one of them offered to share in the karmic hell that was surely to come to him. He was sorely disillusioned by this. He walked with very heavy footsteps back to the sage Narayana. So Narayana asked him, what did they say? Valmiki said, not one of them would share in the karmic hell that's about to come to me. He said, you tell me. I want to live as you live. I want to be fearless as you are fearless. Free me from this delusive life that I have. Teach me how to attain emancipation. And so Sage Narayana taught Valmiki the sacred mantra, Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. And immediately Valmiki started to practice this and entered into a deep state of meditation, for he had many good lifetimes behind him, even though his behavior had been so bad in this lifetime. And through deep concentration and meditation, he became truly purified of all of his past. The healing words of Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram continued to purify his heart, his mind, and his soul. Every part of his body began to resonate with the divine vibration. He felt himself uplifted out of body consciousness and sustained by an inner nectar that kept him sustained in body, even though he had so little body consciousness. He sat in that place for so long that ants came and built an anthill all around him. One day, Sage Narayana came back, and the place where he had left Valmiki found in its place an anthill. So he tore the anthill apart, and there was the sage inside. It had been many years. The purification was complete. And there was that Sage Narayana asked him to go out and continue to work in the world, that he had things yet to accomplish, even though he had his complete and full realization. Of course, Narayana was not in favor of entering back into the world. He wanted to know if there was any that were good in the world. And that was at the time that he was introduced to Rama and the story of Rama, and that he was a true and noble soul. And thus begins the account of the glorious Ramayana, the account of Rama's life and Sita's life. So you see, even a brigand, a killer, somebody who had absolutely no conscience within themselves, grew into full enlightenment by deepened concentration and meditation upon God alone. As Krishna says in this chapter, how much easier is it then for those who are not of such a mind, those who live a more normal life, those who have a larger heart, more empathy, more understanding. How much easier is it then for them to enter into the immortal state? This is, of course, the great message of all the scriptures, that we are immortal. that we are of divine origin. It is at the ending of the year, as we are now and about to celebrate the beginning of the calendar year tomorrow night, that it is a time for reflection upon this past year. A time of reflection where we can think about those goals, those ideals that we held out for ourselves at the beginning of the year. In particular, those spiritual goals that we had for ourselves. Those times that we wish to enter into deepened meditation. That we wish to live a life more closely attuned to our own spiritual nature. That we wish to achieve that highest consciousness of which we are born to attain to. Every one of us in this room have dedicated their lives towards this spiritual goal. We have recognized that the true goal of life is the realization of our oneness with that infinite spirit of which we are, from which we have sprung, by which we are sustained, and in which we will one day be withdrawn into. Every one of us have come into this life to attain the sacred and divine goal. As Papa Ram Dass pointed out, it's not always by strictly retiring from this world, but for many, it is to stay in this world. It is to stay within a family life. And through that action, through that mode of living, we can attain to the very highest consciousness. Lhari Mahasaya has proven that to us. Mother Hamilton has proven that to us. Other saints and sages down through the years have proven that the householder form of life is not a bar to either realizing God or to being in a completely realized state. We must awaken from the fact that we are somehow barred from spiritual development if we are living in this world. And how do we do that? Through Krishna's teaching here, he says, whatever you eat, whatever you enjoy, whatever you love, whatever you experience in this world, do it as a prayer to the infinite. And through this, you and your mind will become purified. Through the purification of the mind, you will truly reflect the divine consciousness, which are your true origins. It is the true source of your being. All else is delusion. This is wisdom, to recognize that anything that has birth dies is of a temporary nature. That your true eternal self ever was, is now, and ever will be. When you come into the true realization of yourself, you will recognize that you have always been. Until then, we identify with this body and we see ourselves as temporary residents upon this earth. And because of that, we live as if we are on shifting sand. The steadfast, solid rock that you can stand upon is the realization that you are the true, eternal self, that you have always been that. But it must be more than a mental recognition. You must grow into the realization of it. You must deepen your meditation. You must dive deeply into your spiritual nature. The mind must be purified. This is done through living prayerfully, living with your mind totally focused upon God, that you love God, you serve God, you worship God in all that you do, that you allow no idea of separation to dominate your mind, that even the idea of separation, see it coming as from a singular source, see it as coming from God. And you automatically link that thought back to its source. Even things that we may consider unholy things that we consider an obstacle. See the true nature and source of it as coming from God. And the moment you do that and you link it back to the source, you help to purify the mind. Let go of the idea that you're a sinner, that you are different than God, that you are separate from Him. And surrender yourself, open yourself to your eternal connection to that divine source. It is a subtle consciousness that begins to dawn upon you when you do this. You begin to feel that even the aches and the pains, the doubts and the misery, the dejections, the darkness, the clouds, they all come from a singular source. As Jesus said to Pontius Pilate, "You would have no power over me were it not given to you from above." In that single sentence, Jesus unites all activities as coming from God. And this is the very truth of your existence. Do not believe in any idea or ideal that separates you from the infinite beloved. Rather, feel yourself, even now, in this moment, connected with your divine source. When you walk, feel that it is the divine source that empowers you to walk. When you speak, feel that it is God who is speaking through you. When you think, feel that it is the thoughts of God that flow through you. Never for a moment remove yourself from that divine source. And very quickly, your mind, your body, your heart and soul will become purified. There are many religions in this world. And when one religion pits itself against another, promotes fear, hatred, a sense of the other, they fall into delusions trap. Should rather feel that all are the children of God. All are evolving and working to evolve towards their infinite nature. One does not stand below or above another. Rather, we stand hand in hand helping one another. There's a great revelation that came to me one time about Babaji and the great masters. And so oftentimes I thought of them as standing above us, looking down upon us, somehow being separate from us. But you see, that was my own delusive idea of separation. In this revelation, I saw that the great masters don't look at us like somebody from up on a skyscraper might look down upon people walking on the sidewalk like little ants going back and forth. Rather, they see themselves in us. They see their own human nature that they once experienced themselves, struggling to emerge into divine consciousness. They see our own struggle as their struggle, and their struggle as our struggle. They don't stand aloof and above, because that would be separation. Rather, they identify with us. They identify with the human that is with. But they also call to us to strive to emerge from that purely human perspective and come into the divine perspective as well. They know what limiting thoughts encapsulate us and imprison us. As surely as any four walls can imprison a human body, those thoughts will imprison a human soul. They know we strive and strive sincerely, that if we work to grow and overcome those limiting thoughts, that we can grow into the same consciousness which they enjoy. They don't think of us as growing into a limited state of God realization, something below them, feeling threatened if we should surpass them or go beyond them. Rather, they feel the great joy of expanding consciousness. They know what lies in front of us. They know what potential resides within us. And it is only by striving that we might attain. We must strive. We must bend every effort in the attainment of our divine realization. Now, how does this striving fit in with grace? Through that striving, that straining, that desire, that intense desire nature, we come up against the limitations of human will and the human mind. We realize that through human will and through human mind alone, divine consciousness cannot be attained. When we come to that point of surrender, that inner surrender, we feel an uplifting grace flow within us. We feel it is intimately tied to us and yet something beyond us. So we know that it is not ourself, our own will, our own mind that is creating this. Rather, we feel ourselves surrendering to that inner divine flow, that presence, that divine will. And we surrender to it and we allow it to move us, to direct us, to do all things through us. We learn through trial and error that the more completely we surrender ourselves to those inner divine workings, the more quickly we seem to be uplifted into God consciousness. The more we try to take the reins ourselves and make things happen and force things to happen through our own will and determination, the more off track we seem to get. Human will, human determination aids us in certain stages of our life and is of great benefit in this world. But when it comes to the higher spiritual path, it becomes an obstacle because it is rooted within the ego. It is only through complete and total subjugation of human will to the divine will that we will know complete freedom and emancipation. We see then that all our own futile efforts have kept us in a prison with limiting thoughts and ideas. Now, surrender is not defeatism. It is a recognition in a very positive, growth-promoting way that the divine spirit is actively working within us and it is responsible for uplifting us. In the same way that we would not know how to make our food digest, to how to make our own heart beat, to how to make many of the mechanisms within our body to operate and when. These things happen automatically. Even so, when you put yourself in the complete surrender of divine grace comes in and performs all the actions necessary in order to purify your heart, mind, and soul. When you feel that divine grace operating within you, you know that it is something beyond yourself. It is an intelligence that is superior to your own. It is a power superior to anything that you could generate yourself. As you surrender yourself to it, you feel your freedom. And thus is one of the greatest paradoxes, that in that surrender, you gain your freedom. And it is a wonderful, it is a beautiful truth to discover. It is a great relief. You become the instrument and God is the operator of the instrument. You feel yourself being carried along upon the divine winds. When you have a question as to where to go, what to do, what to say, you inwardly let go and surrender yourself to those inner divine workings. You do not take up the reins yourself. I remember a spiritual teacher who was one of Master's disciples, and he was talking about he is going to give a talk, and Master had told him to surrender to God's divine will. Well, he got up in front of the group of people and he sat there, and nothing came out. And there he was, in front of a group of people, and no words came, no thoughts came. Instead of staying in a completely surrendered state, He decided that he must use his own will, he must use his own mind in order to articulate the words that he wanted to put out in using the speech. You see, but he missed an opportunity there. If he had stayed in that surrendered state and God had spoken no words to him, then that would have been as God willed in that moment. It is the willingness to look foolish. It is the willingness to go against social convention. And these are great tests that come to us. Who can go against social convention? Who can go against what other people think? Now, some people say, well, I don't care what other people think. I do what I want to do. But they're operating against what other people think. Whatever other people think, they do just the opposite. They're not dependent on other people, they're counter-dependent. But they're equally dependent in their counter-dependence, in their rebelliousness. So it is not true freedom. True freedom comes through inner surrender, the willingness to be as God makes you be in that moment, the willingness to inwardly surrender yourself to all that is. And when you do that, when you go inside and you let go and you sense for that divine source, that divine origin, let that will operate through you, speak through you, do everything through you, you will know an innate joy, an inner freedom, and a flow of consciousness that will ever keep you attuned to your own divine nature. Now, this is not easy. It's a lot of obstacles to overcome. The ego doesn't let go easily. But if you make the effort, you will come to that point of inner surrender where you can truly, completely let go and let God. And when you do that, the most mystical, the most wonderful movements begin to happen within you. And the more you completely surrender to that, the more you earn that inner freedom and light and love. And you become free. And that is the secret life, and the secret of life. Just stop there and see if there are any questions about your own sadhana or great obstacle for him in his own life. A great deal of anger, and get angry just like that. When we're operating out of God consciousness, we always feel an inner calm. Now that doesn't mean that we don't have emotion. We may feel emotion. But that inner calm is our center. That's the place that we operate from. We can utilize angry energy. We just see it purely as energy. And sometimes we may raise our voice, sometimes we may speak sternly, but we never feel controlled by that angry energy. It's not making the decisions. That inner calm is staying right with God. When we give in to anger and it dominates us, most oftentimes we remember an incident, we go, oh, I wish I hadn't spoken like that. I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I hadn't gone with that much intensity about that. That was over the line. And there are moments when we can remember that. when we have that inner calm, we can stay directly on task, say exactly what we mean, be in complete control of what we're doing. And when we have that, and afterwards we can reflect and we can ask God and go inward, inside, and say, was I in line with you all the way through? And we know it. We know it. We know whether we're hiding from ourselves or trying to fool ourselves or whether we're really right where we wanted to be. And if we can say honestly and sincerely, I was exactly where I wanted to be. I said exactly what needed to be said. I felt attuned with God all the way through it. Then we're all right. Doesn't mean that you become a doormat. You look at the lives of many of the great masters, including Jesus. He is far from being a doormat. You know, he entered into the temple, and he said exactly what he wanted to say, and he went against the ruling class at the time. Not an easy thing to do. And they said, who are you? You know, you haven't been trained in our great schools. And, you know, you come in here saying these things about us. But it was the truth, what he said. They never evaluated whether what he said was the truth or not. They wanted to, they were just out to get him. I guess they wanted to defend him. So leading a spiritual life and being in God consciousness does not mean that you're a doormat. Anybody who knew Mother knew that she was far from a doormat. Anybody who knew Master knew that he was not a doormat. And so they could speak very strongly at times and hold up their end of things, and that's needed at times. So far from seeing conflict or anger or difficult situations as something strictly to avoid, no, sometimes they're exactly what need to happen in that moment. But we need to be very careful. We can't be going about fooling ourselves, saying, well, I got the good end of that one, you know, and I gave them a good punch or two, and I gave them a punch for God. You know, that it can't be like that. We can feel when we're kind of elevated, when we're kind of on a high from it, and that's a good indication we're probably caught up in some of the energy, that we're not in that calm, completely clear state. So when we have that calmness, when we have that clarity, when we have that feeling of connection with God and the flow of energy coming from that, then we can rest assured that we're exactly where we should be. Does that make sense? Does that apply to what you were talking about?
Yeah.
It is. And the beauty about it is that it fits right in with our own sadhana. You know, it is what we should be doing all through the day anyway. This is not easy stuff to operate in the day and stay in that centered place. We are so easily pulled into the human interactions, into, you know, that person shouldn't be driving that way. They shouldn't be talking to me that way. They shouldn't be acting that way. And bang. Right in the middle of it. We're pulled right into the whole thing. And not as the observer and not as a witness, but rather as, you know, an egoistic actor within the play. But to stand back and to see that it is God who is the actor, that gives us real freedom, and we feel the difference. Rather than feeling that the world is weighing us down, at the end of the day we feel beat up by events, by people, we feel smooth, we feel even. We feel right with God and right with ourselves. What a difference that is. And how much that is worth to us to live in that way rather than to get pulled into the human element of it. Getting pulled into the human element is completely normal. It's how most people live their lives. So it's not like, well, what's wrong with me that I'm doing this? It's like, well, this is where I'm coming. This is my sadhana. This is what I need to be about. And so it's extracting ourselves by remembering God, keeping that focal point of being the witness, seeing God operate through us, move through us, speak through us. Then we are free. Past
passion can be there, but where it's just like anger, which is a kind of a passion. And you can feel it operate through you, but you're not dominated by it. And that's the key, is that all the three gunas operate through the realized being. You feel it. You feel it flowing through you, around you. You participate in it in that way, but you're not dominated by it. At the core of your being is that inner calm and that inner center that is ever free. In the same way that God has made all of creation and projected that out from himself as an expression, and yet at the same time, he stands as the impersonal spirit that is unaffected by all creation. We're made in that same likeness, which is the spirit, and the image, which is all creation. We too enter into creation, but we also have that individuated spirit from which we can observe everything that happens. And so we experience the three gunas of creation operating through us, but we're always master of it. We're always standing separate from it, able to observe it. When we identify with any aspect of creation and we become that, then we have lost our freedom. We have lost our universality. As long as we can stand apart and stand within our true self and see this world of creation moving all around us but not dominating us, then we have freedom and we have that realized state. Had an image that's similar to that, which is the river of life is flowing by you as the three gunas, and the passions, and all the rest of it. You can stand on the bank and be the observer. See, sometimes it races past you in flood kind of stages. Other times it moves molasses flow and just barely oozing by you. That's standing as the observer. The tamasic then is building a dam. I don't want this river. I want to stop it. I want to control it. And I want to say what passes by me and how it passes by. And so I build a dam. And I block it up and it gets all dammed up behind me. The Rajasic then dives into his alternative Siddhi, and he's swimming in it. He's surrounded in it. He's fully encased in it all. And so the ideal would be in the sattvic, stand on the bank as the observer, watching the river. Diving into it and identifying with it, they're letting it flow by. And by connecting, well, the destruction comes from identifying. That's the diving into it and becoming identified. That's where the feeling of destruction comes from, and that's where we either dam it up and we say, okay, I'm going to control this. Dam it up, and the water builds up and up behind it to a vast reservoir. Or we dive into the feelings, the emotions, the thoughts, and we identify with it. Both of these are problematic. The alternative is to stand on the bank, not try to dam it up, not identify with it. Simply watch that river of sorrow
and bitterness flow by. And even the most tamasic, depressed, stuck kinds of feelings will flow by if we observe it. We truly observe it. It may be like molasses, but it does flow, and then it does change, and then some new water comes through it, and it continues to purify. And as we stand identified with the true self, the mind becomes purified, and this stuff flows by. See, it's all cause and effect, cause and effect. Whatever's flowing by is due to some previous cause on our own part. So we look at it with patience. We look at it with the correct perspective and allow it to flow by. And it will flow. And as it flows through, it changes. And something else comes. And then something else. And it's ever changing. And eventually, as the mind becomes purified, what we recognize this as Ananda. It is all Ananda. And as our consciousness begins to change, we see that Ananda is the music of the river as it flows by. And that it all has a music, but we lose that music when we become identified with it, when we become immersed in the sorrow and the bitterness. It has no music. It has no comfort. It has no beauty. And that is the hellish existence that we're sentenced to. And we just have to endure that as the witness until it flows through, until that begins to change. And that is the dark night of the soul. And we can have had a continuous or a fairly continuous stream of consciousness of God coming to us, and then suddenly we're thrust into this dark night. Not anything of our own doing. Part of our path. It's part of what happens to us along the way. And it's the dark night that St. John spoke of and that all the great spiritual masters have alluded to. And again, it's not because we've made any error in our own sadhana. It is a necessary state for us to go through in the complete purification. And the hardest thing to do is to have patience. Shirdi Sai Baba called it courageous patience. And it is hard. We want to make it go away. We want it to change. We want anything to happen but that. And yet there we are, stuck in it. So we must have courageous patience. We must have persistence. And patience. Must be a courageous patience. It is the complete cleaning out of the cup. In fact, it breaks the cup. But it is the scouring out of all things old, everything we've been hanging on to, things unknown to our own conscious mind, things that we thought we had dealt with, things that we thought we had, weren't even an issue or a problem, and suddenly they come up and they are right in our face. And it is the great purification. So many people, frankly, they bail out at that time. They look for anything else other than that. And they wander and wander the earth, fossils. They kind of fill themselves with other things, but they're all emptiness in the long run. In fact, they get them into trouble a lot of times. So the same obstacle, the same test comes back. Can have more than one. There is the great dark night of the soul that happens during the mystical crucifixion. And all others have been kind of a reflection of that. And the psychological journey and spiritual journey reflect each other. And so many psychological journeys go through dark nights. But this great dark night is when we've been having the active flow and expression and bliss of God in our life, and then suddenly it's cut off. And for me, that lasted for 2 years. And before that, I had had a fairly continuous flow of God. And then not an easy thing to go through, but it is doable. It is doable. You hang on in faith. I knew from Mother's teachings that this was part of the path, that it was something that could happen. I always hope it doesn't happen to you, of course. Or that doesn't happen in a terrible degree. But you hang on. You hang on because you know that it's the only thing of value. But there is truly no other place to go. I think I've told several times, but it's one of my favorite stories of the guru who was testing the disciples who were following him. So one night he says, I want you to follow me. Come to this place. And when they got there, he says, now sit down on the ground. Well, they were outside this brothel. And the guru went inside. He ordered a plate of food, and he said, cover it over with a towel and you bring it in. Well, the disciples saw bringing it in. They had a bottle on there. That must be a bottle of wine. Did you smell meat? I think that was meat on that plate. They're all talking to each other. The disciples, you know, comparing notes. So the guru stayed in this place all night long. Gradually, one by one, different ones got up. They left. Finally, at daybreak, there was only one left. The guru came out. He looked around. Where were the others? He says, well, sir, during the night, they all left. One after another, they got up and they all left. He says, you're here. Why are you still here? The disciple said, other place to go. And that's how you feel during that dark night. There is, you hang on because you know that there is nothing else of value. There is no other place to go. And so you hang on because you must. You must. And you do get through it and you do come out on the other side of it. I remember I had a vision when I first started coming out of this. And in the vision, I was walking along on a path. And I turned around and I saw where I was coming out of. And it was, the land was charred black. The sky was all sooty black. There was nothing on the ground at all. Everything was destroyed. The ground was broken up by great earthquakes all along. And inwardly, I just let out this scream. Just this deep sense of grief that I've been carrying with me for the previous 16 months. And as I let out this yell, I just felt the tremendous weight and burden of carrying all the way through that. And then I turned around and I saw what was in front of me, and it was a beautiful desert, soft brown, soft greens. The desert was in bloom, flowers were coming forward. And I just cried. I just looked at that, and I just, oh. I smelled the air, and the air smelled sweet. There's a spiritual vibration. I have not experienced anything like that in the last 16 or 18 months. And it was just such a relief to see all of that. And that was the beginning of my coming out. It didn't happen all at once. Gradually started coming. Very much part of our journey.
Is that term dark night so necessarily dweller on the threshold?
I don't know dweller on the threshold terminology.
I can't answer your question.
God knows, I bet.
I bet he does. I think it's a thing that gradually we grow into. Master told the story of two young Indian boys who tragically started talking amongst themselves, and one day they decided, well, we trust in God completely, and so anything's possible. They went out into the woods. One friend took the sword to the head of the other friend and cut his head off, and they were thinking in faith that the head would not be severed. Master used this as an illustration that they had not built in, they had not built up to that kind of faith yet. They had overstepped the bounds. So I think in our own sadhana, in our own life, there are those times when we take a leap of faith. We say, all right, this is the prompting that I'm getting. I'm going to act on that, and I'm going to let the consequences fall where they were. You know, Peter stepped out of the boat onto the really rough seas in order to follow Jesus going out there. Now, when he looked around at the water, he says, what have I done? And he starts to sink. And as he's sinking, he looks up at Jesus and he says, Masters, you know, do something. So Jesus said, ye of all faith, you know, take my hand. Come back. And he rose back up. It's not easy. We challenge ourselves, maybe in small ways in the beginning. You know, what should I do here? And sensing inside, intuitively sensing what our prompting is, and then acting on that, and then seeing what the results are of that. Make it for little things in the day. Make it for small promptings that you feel. Act on that. See what the results are. Take that leap of faith. Gradually build up to where you begin to identify what that inner voice is. When it's your own reasoning versus when it's a true intuition and a true prompting. When it comes from that purity of consciousness. And it becomes a vibration that you begin to recognize. You feel the purity of it. You feel the certainty of it. That is also a reflection of the purity and the certainty within your own mind. So it's a gradual process for most people to purify the mind, to take those leaps of faith, to act on it, see where it takes you to, see what the results are, be a keen observer of the results, and progress on, go further. The greatest thing is keeping your mind attuned. You know, one of the things that the devil tempted Jesus with is he took him up on a spire. He says, God will protect you in all things, correct? Jesus said, yes, of course. Let's jump off the tower. Jesus said, no. He says, that's not right. That's tempting God. We shouldn't tempt God. We don't take foolish risks just for grandstanding. But when we feel that inner prompting and we feel that inner movement come within us, then act on it. Move upon it. Practice with that. Sense it. Observe what the results are of that. And gradually grow into it. So don't start out usually basing life-changing decisions on the inner prompting. Work with small things through the day and gradually build up to it, to where you feel more and more confidence in that, recognizing that vibration, recognizing that force within you. That's with the mind, and at some point you'll find that the mind is actually interfering with that flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then you just stay attuned to that flow. But we should do it from an alert, awake status of the mind, and that where is this coming from the purity? Because there are a convergence of our own will and of divine will, and sadhana is about purifying the mind so that it's only divine will. But that doesn't happen in a day. So we're gradually purifying the mind, gradually attuning it to that higher divine will. And we recognize where the ego comes in there and takes over. You know, suddenly there's, I'm pretty big stuff here. Look at what's going on here. You know, and suddenly, just like that, we're off the track. So the ego gets in there and it finds its little voice and it starts whispering to us. And that's where we need to be very exacting in our spiritual science. We need to be very exacting within our thinking. We have lots of examples where God told me, you know, thus and thus, you know. And we look at that and we go, well, I don't think so. I don't think so. And so it's easy to get caught up in the ego. And that's what all the stories are about. That's what all the scriptures are about, is the way that people get caught up in the ego on their spiritual journey. So with that exacting attitude, with that adherence for absolute truth, for that surrender to divine will, always willing to question, is this divine will or human will? It's a good place to start from.
Is what I've noticed is that if you come out of that state where I'm at right now, it's just where that merge starts.
Uh-huh.
And we start to work together, but then slowly it all becomes me. And it happens so slowly and so subtly that when I've done it for a project, I suddenly realize I'm out of it.
Right.
And it's just like, oh.
Right.
Like, I wasn't able to stay in there.
And that is our sadhana. You know, it's rising up to the heights, it's getting that view, it's going back down into the valley and getting immersed in things, going back up to the peak again, staying a little longer, getting a little bigger view, going back down into the valley. That is sadhana. That is our life. And, you know, we're given Kriya Yoga, we're given chanting God's name, we're given lots of wonderful tools, but they're still sadhana. That's right. That's right. There's still sadhana. There's just no way around it. It's just that's our path. And we can't be afraid of it. If we're so afraid of making a mistake or doing something wrong that we don't act, that's not helpful either. So we have to be willing to act, but act with sincerity, act with integrity, willingness to expose this is the truth. Is this the truth? Be very exacting about it. Be very rigorous with yourself. And your sincerity will be your best guard and your best guide. If you make a mistake and you have complete sincerity, you'll get it. You'll get so far down that path and you'll realize, I've lost it here. I started out, it seemed good. I started out on the right beam, but I got sidetracked. And when we pay close attention that way, we learn from, where did I get caught up there? And then how do I get back on? You can't be so caught up in your own, you know, need to be right that you're unwilling to question yourself. The greatest masters learn that humility. That's why they identify humility as such a great asset on the path. Childlike humility, childlike surrender. They realize how easily the ego gets in there, starts to distort, delete, move things around until it's unidentifiable from where you started from. And you're caught up with the idea, I'm doing something good here. You know, I'm going to change myself. I'm going to change the world. I'm going to help others. And you get so caught up and so bound up in that, that you can go on like that for lifetimes. And that's why Papa said that you can do no good until you have complete realization. And that's a very helpful guard, actually, because we can get so caught up in the idea of doing good. Well, how do we know what doing good is? How do we know what end result is going to come from our actions? You just don't do any predictable good. You don't know. The mind can never ascertain enough information to know what is going to happen as a result of this action. So say you try to set out to heal somebody. You set out to change somebody's life. You set out to try to help somebody. The human mind can make its best effort at trying to determine what help is, what good is, what a good change will be. But the reality is it can never ascertain enough information to know what that is. But when you surrender inwardly and you feel that inner prompting come, do this much and no more. From a human standpoint, people may say, well, that looks cruel, or why aren't you still helping, or why aren't you doing something else? Well, that inner direction said no more, so I stopped there. And that inner prompting, if it's coming from God, by definition, is connected to the whole and is for good. And so that's the only way to do anything that's predictably good is through that inner attunement with the divine source. And so that's what that means. You may haphazardly do something good, but it can't be predictably until you have that inner attunement. And even then, some of the masters, the way they act, you know, sometimes they throw rocks at people, sometimes they abuse people, they do all kinds of things.
And when I do that, I
get in trouble. Exactly right. Exactly right.
Until you have that in your team, and that's why God gave the rules like Ten Commandments, so that you operate out of those principles until you can completely attune yourself with God and your
As a writing teacher once told me, he says, you have to learn all the rules of grammar before you can break them. Then you can break them, willy-nilly, but you have to learn all the rules first.
I'm wondering, David, I just wanted to ask a question. I don't quite know how to ask it, but what's the relationship between a group process one goes through and one's mm-hmm. You know, I think when Mother was very powerful, and a number of people were going through very powerful experiences, and then when she, you know, was very sick, and we all kind of tended to go through someone of a group, Dark Night of the Soul.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, you're on your individual path as well at the same time. What's that relationship?
Well, of course, we all come together because we have that karmic relationship, we have that karmic tie. So we're going to share in a lot of aspects of the spiritual path. Not everything, of course. You have your own individuality, and ultimately it is always an individual path. But that we can share the strength and the difficulties of what it is to be a group. You know, sometimes you come across personalities that are unlovely, and they're difficult for you individually to deal with. And yet, that can be a really safe environment to learn to see God within that personality, to see God operating behind that individual. Groups will go through highs and lows together. And the lesson is always the same, and that is to individuate through that and to realize that this is all God's play, whether it's happening internally, as different forces operating within you or within a group and different forces operating within a group. It's really no different.
I get tricky as well when you're either experiencing it in conjunction with somebody else or you're experiencing it on your own and you're all going to experience it in different intensity.
The advantage, one of the nice things about seeing it represented outside of ourselves is it's difficult to see ourselves. And when we see another person, we go, that, you know, how they do that. Well, that's a force that's inside of us. We wouldn't have that really vigorous emotional reaction to another person unless it resonated somehow with some conflict that we have within ourselves. Otherwise, we would just say, well, that's an interesting way for them to be. You know, it's not my way, but it's but that really deep registering of an emotion, a negative emotion, an oppositional emotion, it's really a good indication that it represents something inside of us. Conversely, somebody who is wonderful in our eyes, and we see them as just a wonderful example, that is also resonating with the positive force within ourselves. So when we see it manifesting outside of ourselves, it's oftentimes easier to see it, to interact with it, than when it is just a force within ourselves. And we can use those as an opportunity for growth. So that's another way that the internal and the external can operate together. Because we're here to work, you know. It's, as I say sometimes, that's why they call it sadhana and not vacation. We're not here for vacation. We're here for work. We're here for sadhana. And we get confused a lot. We think if life is hard or if we're in some difficulty, our life must be wrong somehow. And that's just not the case. That's why we're here. And our sadhana is not disconnected from our life. It's not like, well, if I didn't have this lousy job or this terrible boss at work, you know, then I'd be happy, or then I could perform my spiritual practice better, or just fill in the blank of whatever you want to have changed. No, that is your spiritual sadhana. That's perfectly designed for you in order to release you from something that's binding you, something that's holding you. So it's wonderful to have a group, and sometimes excruciating. Doesn't mean it's not wonderful. That's right. That's the ego. See, when you're truly in God, you accept whatever comes to you, high or low, good or bad, however the mind judges it, you accept it as God. And when you truly have that, you have peace, and you have peace even through trying times. And that is the great gift of spirit, is that peace that surpasses all understanding. Why all understanding? Because it goes beyond reason. It goes beyond the mind. Okay. Just a couple of announcements. We have service tomorrow night for our New Year's service. It will be from 8 o'clock to midnight here. We will not have Wednesday night service here, and then we'll meet next Sunday, 7:30 here, and that will be my last time here for the next until April. So, but we will continue to meet here, and I don't know if we've worked out a schedule for while you guys are gone. I know Chad offered to come and open the house, and Jill offered her house. Chad come in, and so we'll just continue to meet here. Sunday and Wednesday, or what is your schedule allow for? Okay. And we'll play tapes during those times. Okay. And so there'll be lots of comings and goings from India. We'll have lots of wonderful stories when we get back. It's sadhana. But it's lovely sadhana. And it's still sadhana. That's right. And we'll all appreciate your love and prayers as you stay here. And tell you a cute story. Ruth and Charles, I think most of you know Ruth, and Charles is her husband. a statistician, and he's a member of our spiritual family, but a little bit on the periphery. And so he's giving Ruth a little bit of bad time about all this, going to India and to these different temples and that kind of thing. And she says, Charles, who else has a wife going to all these different spiritual places and praying for your soul every place that she goes? He just smiled, shook his head, and left the room. So we shall all be praying for your souls as well. And I hope that you all continue to come and take the spiritual vibration. And of course, inwardly attuned, just think of us being there. And what I have found is being at an anandashram, just thinking of myself being there, thinking of myself being in the same room as Swami Satchidananda, and I'm there. All the vibration, all of the presence, everything of being in that place. So just put your mind there. You'll save yourself the cost of the plane trip, and the humidity and the heat, and you'll just be there. God's prompting. For Laura's mother? Yeah. I have, for your mother, for Treva. Yeah. I want to just, what's wrong with your mom?
She's had 3 weeks of
symptoms. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Also, a tragedy down in Ashland. Peter sent up an email, and Laura's mother was hit by she was physically saved, but mentally she's not coming around, and I don't think they expect her to. So she's a lovely, lovely woman, Joan. And so we'll miss her. So we'd like to send prayers to her and to all the family down there. Of course, the children are understandably upset. And they have to make some difficult decisions around what they want to do. And prayers for Treva. And anyone else?
Just the state of the world over there and prayers for peace in India and Pakistan.
India and Pakistan, who are doing a little saber rattling right now. And to see the cool heads and calm hearts. Stand. Whether you know these souls or not, your soul knows these souls. Feel the light within you, the light of perfection, the light of wisdom, the light of all healing. So you go out to these souls and regions of the world. See you all uplifted, given peace, harmony, and understanding. came to me is when I heard of Joan, and I was thinking and praying about her. A very strong image came to my mind of Joan. She said, "It's okay." Please join me in the closing prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. Feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body, my mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I am Thy brother. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Peace. Bliss.